Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host
Fabio 1701. I'm a Polycast virgin, so this is new for me.
Oh, man.
This gave him so much ammo.
I had to phrase it that way.
I approve.
Welcome, everyone, to another Polycast. We got five people on today, and in the tradition of Polycast, I'm going to mess up everyone's names. We'll start off with Dan Q.
What's old is new again?
Makalua?
Coffee.
Then we have the Me In Team. Mad Jin.
Dan's just trying to say that he's 18 again.
And he likes it?
Finally, myself as a guest, Fabio 1701. And I'm only here because I hate my job.
And the next day your employer calls. About that job you hate, no worries anymore. What?
To be honest, I don't think anyone at my work has the intellectual capacity for a Civ game, so I'm...
Wow. You thought your problems ended when you lost your job. Nope, coworkers come knocking on the door the day after.
It's weird to call it stupid.
Yeah. They don't even play Call of Duty. They're not even that fun. They're not computers.
Are you saying they're not even stupid enough to play Call of Duty? Whoa, whoa, let the hate mail rain in.
Yeah, luckily I don't have a Twitter account, so I can say this kind of stuff without my computer exploding.
Bill might explode at you.
Although I did have to ask you a question, Fabio. What iteration of the USS Enterprise are you the model spokesperson actor for?
Oh, thank God someone realized what it was from. I would say that I'm a big fan of Enterprise B, because that's the one where you can least catch someone on all the faults, because not much has been written about it.
Well, fair enough. To be or not to be, that's the question.
I apologize right away. There's not even a two. Months, are we?
We're off to a good start here.
By good start, you mean we need to orbital baseball cannon, yes.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Before we actually get to the first topic, have you seen the chat today? The Ustream chat?
I saw somebody said they would get here early while I was sleeping, but haha, the joke's on you. It's already awake.
Okay, so you've seen it. Please, please read exactly what the Star of Hope had to say about you. Clarice.
He said, I thought I'd come early while the Mackie was sleeping. She's scary when she's awake.
Nice. This might kill you for your cup of coffee.
And then what else?
You know, like, she might kill you for your cup of coffee. No, I know how to acquire my own cups of coffee, thank you.
Just have to kill you for it, but she might.
If you get between me and the cup of coffee, we might have to have a problem.
I'm pretty sure Mackie only became scary when she's awake, when she found out that Alpha Centauri 2, or the spiritual successor, was in development and she couldn't play it yet. Uh-oh.
And it has new factions. I'm totally going to have to change which one I'm playing first now.
She joined my faction, Mackie.
We have some feedback for both Polycast episode 205, where we had exclusive dev Q&A, and 206, where we just kind of facepalmed around for a while.
Wait a minute, how's that different than usual, though?
It's not. That's why I said qualified to episode 205, because it was different, sort of.
Yeah, the other one was just usual.
So anyways, other than Dan talking to somebody about issues in listening to the episode, because it didn't fully download.
Other than that,
I have to skip down a little bit. Blasty was confused about the backlash against the pre-order map pack. This must be Dan, of course.
Yep.
He looked at mightyape.co.nz pre-order that weekend, and at exactly what the pre-order bonus was there. So Dan went off on pre-order bonus preemptively, prematurely.
Well, and actually, I didn't even respond, because not only is this registering with me now, when he talks about seeing that this was on Friday the 11th, before you posted the cast.
Yeah.
We recorded it also the week before. I didn't even pick up on that till now, but anyway.
I'm still.
I noted in reply that I checked the American, Canadian, and UK ones at the time, and none of them did. So then I said, kudos to Mighty Ape. Also, Mighty Ape. That was a secondary criticism of mine. The view was more no ready description of or even listing of what was included in the map pack from the official Civilization website, and that this is to be day zero downloadable content, so why is it not included as part of the base game?
Yeah. But yes, if we record the show on, say, the 4th
and then you say you listen to it on the 11th, we got you beat by a week. Always keep in mind everything is a week earlier. Otherwise, yeah, day zero date content, it's maps. It's not even content, really. It's maps. Some people might use it. I guess that defines content, but it's not like it's a gameplay mechanic or something else along that line.
To that, I just say slippery slope.
It does seem a little odd to do the DLC. That does annoy me at some level.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's not a big deal, but it does annoy me a little.
It annoys everybody except for the people who are making it and want to make more money off it.
Yeah.
Now, granted, actually, I just had this conversation the other day with some people. Destiny, the new giant game that's getting $500 million spent on it. Two Day Zero expansions.
What?
You want to whine about freaking Day Zero downloadable content of maps for Civ? Go check out Destiny where you can pre-order two expansions.
Something worse doesn't make a bad thing better.
Context.
You know what? I never thought I'd say this. Thank you, Phil.
It is a weird day now. What the heck?
Okay, so moving on to episode 206. Something about World of Warcraft was not so much that it was addictive to play, but it's because subscription-based game always compelled to play. Shegalo was talking about that stuff. So.
Yeah, because we talked about a list from Rolling Stone, the most addictive video games. Not the best, not even favorite, most addictive.
Yeah, and that if you're paying monthly for WoW, you probably should play it. Otherwise, why are you paying for it?
Well, not that Blizzard would care, as long as they have your money.
Yeah, yeah.
I was actually surprised that on that list, because I listened to it again just to think about what was said, and there's no EVE Online on that list. And that game is so incredibly addictive that I decided, like, after a three-week free trial run, not to buy it because I knew it would ruin my life. And I know, like, this EVE Online is a ridiculously steep learning curve, probably the steepest learning curve I've ever seen, but if you have the get-up-and-go to get past that learning curve, you get sucked in forever. You don't leave.
Yeah.
Well, I guess EVE just didn't ruin enough lives at Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
Probably because the learning curve is too steep for those guys.
Yeah, because WoW you can get into very easily, whereas EVE you have to spend some time with it.
Wow, the learning curve was too great for those guys. So after your boss, after your coworkers, Rolling Stone staff.
Got to Rolling Stone.
I'm taking a number. I'm in line.
Yep. Speaking about getting in line, Magma Dragoon went and did a slam on original StarCraft. Said it was a crappy game. Apparently Total Annihilation was far better RTS.
Ooh, that's pushing it.
That is questionable. And it came out a year earlier as more addictive, blah, 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 blah. Random side point for the Rolling Stones top 10 list. They probably got the list of games from somebody else who already had an opinion about it. They probably never played any of those games when they actually wrote the article. I'm just going to say that.
These top 20 lists of whatever, it's taken from someone else's, someone else's, someone else's thing. When I see one of those, I'm basically assuming whoever wrote this has no idea what they're talking about, and they want the clicks.
So moving on to not Rolling Stones related stuff. When we were talking about the Reddit poll.
Yeah, how placed it. Yeah, the 20,000 responses, yeah, from June.
Yeah, that thing. Nick31 chimed in saying he was surprised to hear little support for patronage, particularly left side. He goes on to say what it actually gives, but realistically, left side of patronage is not very strong. I don't think we're missing out. I think we all know that patronage got nerfed pretty hard a long time ago, and that rationalism is always better. And if you have a choice of patronage or rationalism, you go rationalism, because it's better, period. I mean, if you do get like 10 to 15 allies, city-state allies, then yes, patronage can give you some stuff. But if you're getting 10 to 15 city-state allies, the game was over a long time ago and it's not really worth playing.
Well, that depends on how many city-states you put in the game. If you play with 40 city-states and you're Greece, patronage bumps up Greece's already good city-state alliance mechanics. If you're not, meh.
Well, you just go with one of the ideologies to constantly gain new influence with the city-states anyways. So, I mean, there's small boosts in there, but if you're going to spend policies, every ideology is better than patronage. And, frankly, it's a choice. You have to make a choice. What do you want? And right now, rationalism into ideologies is still better than patronage, by far. So John Gunn comes to explain a lot of that, especially the timing and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, the science for patronage is a small fraction of rationalism, and typically there's only two fillers between completing the first tree and the time rationalism can start, whereas happiness from patronage, that's actually less than what you'd get from monarchy alone, to condense his response. And then Nick31 responded as well, saying, ha, you take patronage after completing tradition, and if you're quick culturally, you can open up at least two patronage policies before being able to open rationalism.
If you're trying to open patronage before you finish tradition, you're giving up on all that wonderful food and growth bonuses of tradition, and that's not talking about the aqueducts for the upper level stuff. So, yeah. Finishing tradition if you go tradition is generally quite important.
He concludes, that's Nick31, by saying, as to the overall nature of the survey, I think people are fiddling with other things after tradition rather than organizing a good patronage game. I personally find that to fend off aggressive AI, having a good city-state core is important. Not in all circumstances, of course, but if I'm culturally doing well, it's a complement to rationalism that will follow. I rarely touch right-side patronage, but left-side, even if just taking up to science, is three quickish policies.
Actually, then you're sort of doing it wrong, because the right-side plus 20 influence base is the one you actually want there. Because that means you get closer to being able to have them permanently friendly, which is kind of hard to actually do, because they've been messing with the numbers.
And when he says, personally find that to fend off aggressive AI, having a good city-state core is important, my question is, what do you mean by aggressive?
And what do you mean by a good city-state core?
Yeah, you mean, what, they're your meat shield? I don't...
yeah, I mean, depending on the position of them, they could make a nice meat shield, because eventually they'll fill up their own little area full of units, and that will take a lot of pain to push through. But some city-states will range very far away from their lands, and others will not. So it sort of depends on which ones you get. Like, if you get the really aggressive city-states, where they'll leave their territory to go attack other cities and then take them, that's definitely a good city-state ally to have. Other than that, city-states, you never leave combat up to the AI. Never a good plan.
Well, if you want good combat, you shouldn't leave it to the AI, period. But, yeah.
Yes.
The people
are the heroes now.
Email and tweet. Actually, emails, plural. Oh, my. I know recently this year, Imagine talked about us receiving email as very controversial. Well, the controversy continues. Again, emails and tweets from Jean-Olivier Pitre. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it properly. If you follow the tweet, he says, I downloaded more than 377 podcasts from the Polycast. Can I go through all the backlog before the release of Civilization Beyond Earth? Challenge accepted. And this was on the 22nd of July, so he's challenged himself. And so, yes, that's Polycast, Modcast, Revcast, Civcast, and Turncast, to which I, on behalf of the Polycast panel, responded 5 days later. We support you in this challenge. But he actually emailed the show before ever posting that tweet. Just recently got addicted to Civ, and I'm undertaking the daunting task to listen to every podcast you have. Great job. You guys are super entertaining. I've already finished every Turncast. Now I'm about to listen to every Revcast. Cheers again and have a nice day. And I kind of did a double take. Wait, you started with Turncast?
I was going to say, I hope you think we're as entertaining when you get to Polycast. Is that the maximum entertainment level? Is that?
I wonder if he's listening on double speed.
That could be actually more entertaining.
I do that sometimes for podcasts. I notice that some people, newscasters, speak a lot slower than others. For example, in the BBC, they speak a lot faster than they do for CNN. And so sometimes I listen double speed just so that it's like we talk normally. So maybe just to give him a bit more challenge and trip him up, we should start talking really fast right now so that he doesn't have to go on double speed.
Well, if he's going on double speed, I guess all we have to decide is between Madge and Phil and myself, who's Alvin, who's Simon, and who's Theodore? And Mackie, are you Brittany or Eleanor? Or there are probably people listening to the show. What are the chipmunks?
Oh, the size of people listening to the show who didn't even get the download of the chipmunks reference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, shame on them. And now my line started. The gentleman follows up to say, I've already reached the 15th episode of Revcast now. This was a week later. It requires a bit more attention than Turncast, which was lighter and funny. Well, first off, it is lighter, and I'm impressed that you find it funny. Good. I'm listening to these podcasts while I'm programming, so sometimes I have to rewind to really listen to the strategies, tips, and tricks. Turncast was much easier to listen in background mode, but gave a good introduction to some of the personalities on the Polycast, I think. Smiley face. You know, and I always viewed it the other way around, that if you want to listen to Turncast, listen to Polycast so you have an idea of what our personalities are. But okay.
No, it could work either way.
It's a two-way street, I guess. He then said, I stumbled upon Polycast via Google, Twitter, and the search option in my podcast application on my Windows phone. The truth is I've been looking for a long time to join a gaming community, but never felt quite at home in any of the communities I tried. But this time, with Civilization, I really feel like I belong here. So far, I love the depth and the maturity of the conversations in the forums, the element of learning in the game, and the high replay value. Also, I feel that the community is not driven by just teenagers. The game seems to attract gamers from all ages and backgrounds, and I really enjoy that. I don't want to sound elitist or snobbish, but the level of conversation in some gaming communities really turned me off. And as a side, I think you will get the stereotypical teenager, but also even just stereotypical troll and people who are not mature despite whatever their age is. After all, age is just a number. He concludes by saying, well, since I want to be part of this community, I want to know everything about the history of Civilization. I don't want to feel like I've missed something, and that's why I decided to listen to all of the podcasts. I'm loving it so far. Cheers. Aww.
Well, major kudos to this guy for listening to this while programming and using a Windows phone.
Yeah.
You know what I want to see? I want to have a look at the code afterwards and see what he named some of his variables. There's probably a variable named Madjin and Dan.
Gandhi.
Check level of Mackey's coffee.
Mute for Diplo. This thread started by Revelation 2:16. Man, you gave me an easy name to pronounce. What the heck? Does Raging Barbarians make you change your build order?
Just as an aside, Phil, the reason I had you choose this topic was not because I wanted you to be able to properly pronounce a username, but when I thought of Raging Barbarians, I thought of you.
Well, thank you. I mean, certainly. I'm the logical choice for this. I thought that went without saying, but fair enough. And the answer is no, because you always open the honor.
Is that really a build order, though?
Well, I mean, you also spam units to kill everything, so that includes the barbarians. But no, it seems to me the much higher threat of improvements getting pillaged slash worker stolen means you must be more robust with your defense. What do you do to counter that threat while still being strong on growth, culture, science, and matching the AI on its significant turn zero advantages on immortal plus difficulties? And he goes on to say he's typically playing on Pangea, and typically immortal, it seems. Most of the thread is just answering to, you know, throw in a couple of early archers and play Montezuma. For any, you just have to get used to the timings, like what you can get away with.
Well, I find it's hard to compare because I have not played without Raging Barbarians in so long I don't remember what it was without them. And I think that's the case for a lot of people I noticed in the forum saying, well, that's just kind of standard for me, Raging Barbarians.
Yeah, there were a number of people who said that. And they certainly do offer you the potential for benefits as well, Raging Barbs do.
Farming for culture.
Exactly. Civ 4 had no such thing.
But there's also stealing workers, which have been captured from other civs. There's the slowing down of the spread of other civs, so it kind of lightens the difficulty level, because I never thought, okay, the barbs got close to my capital. It's like, well, they're not really attacking. One swordsman and one arrow guy can kind of keep them away. I'm not too worried about them, and my scouts are faster than most of them when they're exploring. Yeah.
Oh, and you can also farm city-state opinion, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
It's good times.
I think in one respect, turning Raging Barbarians on is a way, at least psychologically, to up your difficulty level without upping your difficulty level. But at the same time, that's only going to be realized more in the earlier game, because if you don't survive the earlier game with Raging Barbarians, then you're not going to have to worry about the mid to late game because you're dead or so frustrated that, you know, you might as well be. But I think Craig Mack really gets to the point here when he says, it causes me to change my behavior more than build order. Tending to keep my units closer to home to protect workers rather than roaming to the edges of the continent exploring the world. I think, actually, when you turn Raging Barbarians on, which I've done on a few occasions, it had me doing not so much spawn busting like in Civilization 4, but more like just being on the lookout for barbarians that would then roam into the immediate vicinity. So in that respect, when I get enough military units, I might have a border. So rather than having my particular unit protecting a worker, like being right on the tile, just have them a little farther out so that I can see what is coming my way. But then when you start filling out the map, then the Raging Barbarians, yeah, they're still raging, but you're going to lessen the amount of map space they have to do much of anything. So for me, it changes my behavior more than my build order, although it does, but that's only in the early to mid game. After that, it really doesn't change a lot of anything.
Barbs are early stuff.
I would definitely agree with that, that it's more behavior changing than build order changing, because I remember a while ago there was a poll about how many scouts do you build first. 1, 2, 3, very much dependent on most people's answers on the land layout, but people tend to mostly build a scout or two, and depending what they do with those scouts depends on the layout of the land, the barbarians. In the later game, yeah, the only thing you really have to worry about when there's very little space, especially if it's a smaller map by the early classical age, you're worried mostly about barbarians on the sea pillaging your trade routes and not really about raging barbarians on land.
I think actually the bigger thing it would change for me than even build order and my behavior in general, to tie into actually what Phil was saying at the start, which is a social policy choice. I'd be more inclined to at least open honor. I mean, yes, for the increased combat against barbarians, I think it's 25%, but especially in that early game, knowing where the camps are, because I would probably still build one or two scouts depending upon the size of the map and the type of map so I can explore and try to minimize the likelihood that my scout is going to come across some of these party poopers. They don't have to be anything but.
I would agree with that.
Poop, but, really? You're going that way?
Yeah.
But what? Mad Haxor said, why would I have a preset build order? That doesn't sound fun. So he kind of took this to a meta level, and Trackmaster said, yeah, a preset build order might make sense if you're playing a game that was meant to be played online and you were super competitive. When you're playing a game against AI, presumably you're doing it for fun. I'm sorry, so when you are in multiplayer, you're not doing it for fun? And you're not super competitive when you're against the AI? I question this.
It's a good thing to question, but there might be a degree of more people role-playing when they're against the AI as opposed to more people playing against the challenge to actually win in multiplayer. For the same reason, if I'm role-playing, to bring it back to what we were talking about earlier, I might choose patronage and just not do rationality purely just to give myself the challenge and actually role play. This is how this civilization panned out. They're interested in this and not that. And so that choice is you can make for role play. And I would imagine more people role play with the AI because role playing online against humans, that's not going to cut it. The humans will kill you.
Yeah, I could see you maybe deciding to choose patronage over rationalism, if generally speaking, if you wanted to handicap yourself too and also up your difficulty level without upping your difficulty level. Hey, look at that. Raging Barbarians no longer giving you difficulty. You want to keep that difficulty level up? Choose a less stellar social policy. Woo! Let the hate mail begin. And as the Star Hope says in the chat, when it's multiplayer, it's only co-op-ish. Ha-ha! Always with the ish. Speaking of ishes.
If ishes were wishes, then we'd have more XCOM units, what?
Pew pew!
So I sort of started thing over on CFC about XCOM over Parrot. Point out that these are literally like paratroopers on steroids. They can teleport wherever you want in a 40-cell radius. They have 100 strength and powerful against cities. I've conquered a 200-plus defense city with 4 missile cruisers and a couple of XCOMs, while others are raiding 2 or 3 cells outside the city. You can build one every 2 turns in 3 or 4 of your cities and have enough missile cruisers and destroyers for protecting its submarines. You can destroy coastal cities at will. Now, he only tested this on Emperor, but as far away in the game as they are, of course they're overpowered. I mean, you've gone that far in the tech tree, you're meant to have some overpowered toys to work with, especially if you run up against somebody who has those 200-plus defense cities, which, by the way, nukes would be a little bit faster than destroyers.
I think the issue for me and the comparison to the, of course, the giant death robot is that, yeah, but giant death robots require uranium, and yes. XCOM, you can just churn out like there's no tomorrow.
Yes, and then you spend all of your uranium on nukes to wear the cities down, and then XCOM guys just waltz right in.
Okay, I'm just going to point out to something.
I'm just going to point out to something. I love that preface. Yes.
He's saying that XCOM units are powerful things, but he prefaces this with, I'm using 4 missile cruisers to shoot the city until it's damaged, and then use an XCOM unit to walk in.
Wait, yeah, what's the point? You not, can use a warrior to do that.
Yeah, not that he's just dropping in XCOM units, smashing the 200 defense city, and not bombarding it first. No, no. He's bombing it with the 4 missile cruisers first, and then using the XCOM units.
Yeah, because a few times I've taken a city when it was only XCOM units, I didn't have any way to bombard because it was deep in a continent. It took me cycling them out like you would normally with a melee type unit into it. They did not just waltz over the city.
Yeah, so missile cruiser OP.
Yeah, so missile cruiser is OP, not the XCOM unit.
Oops. Well, I would say it's not so much the power of the XCOM unit, but it's the fact that they can paratroop so far. In fact, the existence of the XCOM unit has completely changed the way that I play the late military game if I'm going conquering. It used to be I would have a whole bunch of bombers and a whole bunch of tanks and tank rush everyone. I don't even build tanks anymore. I don't even build tanks in, like, the World War II era, because I go so fast by that point, the technology, that instead of building infantry, I build paratroopers, because they upgrade to XCOM, and then I have an army of XCOM and a whole bunch of stealth bombers, and I just leapfrog from city to city. For me, the XCOM strength is the fact that they can paratroop so far away, the same distance as a stealth bomber that a normal paratrooper cannot do. And so, yeah, I mean, that's all I need. I just need to quickly go over there, jump over someone's entire army, take out their 4 cities or 5 cities within a span of a few turns, and it doesn't matter they have a million tanks. They haven't even engaged in combat with them.
Yeah, that 40 hex range, which even if you're across continents, there's probably not 40 hex difference. So you might need to bombard either with a ship, if it can reach it on the coast, or even with a bomber units immediately adjacent to a city so you can drop the XCOM unit. But then when you also combine with the fact that the XCOM cannot be intercepted, like there's no chance that they're going to be intercepted. Even if you've got fighters, for example, man, oh man, all those things combined, and then the resource thing we were talking about before. I mean, I get the argument that the Star of Hope is saying late game military units exist, so if you're going military and get that late, you end the game.
Yeah.
Yes, but there needs to be some checks and balances here.
There is, because somebody could have won before you got to the XCOM unit.
Yeah, you're pretty far down the tree.
Yeah. But still, at the same time, if you are that far down, it just seems to me where the combined arms and also the effort to, and I'm thinking more actually moving your units in position where they have the chance to be intercepted, like, for example, tanks either on the water or on the land on the way to the city, that there just needs to be that a little more effort involved.
Okay, keeping in mind that you have to be able to see where you're shooting, so in a human versus human situation, everybody has late game stuff, then you're not going to allow anybody to see the area, except for the potential spy thing, but whatever. And XCOM units are basically otherwise, except for the extreme mobility, about the same combat strength as the other units in that era, i.e. everything except for GDRs. So, yeah, you build XCOMs, I build tanks, you can't, and lots of stealth bombers. Boom.
Oh, well, sure, less of an issue in player than it is in single player, but the vast majority of the play here is in SP.
Yeah, but guess what? The game's over. Well, I mean, you could have nuked the crap out of everybody before you got an XCOM squad. So.
And sometimes if when your game runs that far, you just want to build XCOM squads and giant death robots and have a little fun.
I think you can still have a little bit of fun if you're in that late game, but it doesn't have to be to that extreme.
It is an extreme, because it destroys the combined arms effect. You started the game as a late technology game, like the information age. You quickly get to a point where combat is not combined arms. There is nothing to do with combined arms anymore. You have your XCOM, and you have your bombers, and who else needs more?
Well, let's be honest here. Between nukes and air power, how much combined arms did you really need before XCOM?
Like, seriously, I've got nukes. I flatline your entire nation. And I don't even need to see it. No, rough.
What if there's a non-proliferation treaty and you haven't built nukes?
What if there's not?
In a late-era start.
And then you have stealth bombs.
Yeah, no. Late-era start? No. You set it up. I nuke the crap out of you. You have nothing. You can try and vote all you want, but I actually have an empire and you don't.
I'm going to vote you down so fast it's not even funny.
And besides, one nuke wipes out all units on the tiles. One full nuke, anyway.
Yeah, what army did you have? Oh, wait, not anymore.
Oh, I don't care how many CRs you had. I have one nuke.
Yeah, well, you still have to be able to move in and take the city. So if it's inland, boy, oh boy, that XCOM is going to really help. Oh, I don't have to worry about the irradiated land slowing my troops down. No, no, just boom.
Yes, but
it's a great compliment. Oh, I agree. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, but keep it
too good.
Mind.
Dan just doesn't like the modern era.
You have to see it. And a 200 strength city versus an XCOM that has 100 strength. That sounds pretty much like every other melee versus city combination out there during the game. So you still need some sort of ranged attack to break it down. So it's not really that the XCOM squad is strong. It's that you can move around.
And if you wanted to make it even ridiculously overpowered, Trivia suggested in the thread that you build XCOM in an Alhambra plus Brandenburg city. You'd have Blitz right off the bat so you could drop and move. Oh.
Your assertion has been proven wrong, Dan.
Dan hasn't played enough XCOM is the problem.
No, it has not been proven wrong.
Nope.
GDRs.
Nah, just you don't even need the GDR.
But it's fun.
It takes too long to get to the GDR.
I know.
XCOM squad, it's at the end of the game. Seriously, the game's already won by the time you make it there.
It just helps make the cleanup not such of a chore.
Yeah, if the cleanup takes you an extra 100 turns because your units are still really crappy.
And for that reason, there should be some kind of endgame overpowered thing, because at one point you're like, okay, I've obviously won, but I have to clean up this mess just so that the game ends. I don't want to spend a million turns doing this.
Yeah, I hate those games.
At least have it tied to a strategic resource so that you're not able to build so many an infinite item at one time.
Yeah, you could do that, like aluminium, but I have so much aluminium by that time in the game that I can build a gazillion stealth bombers.
And then in that case, you might want a few less stealth bombers because you're going to then need an XCOM unit. As an example, wouldn't have to be the only unit, an XCOM unit to be able to finish the take the city.
You need one. You stealth bomb the crap out of it, you drop in one XCOM squad, take the city. Next turn, you stealth bomb the crap out of the next city, drop over the XCOM squad.
Pretty much.
But at the very least, at least there would be a delay in the timing of it. You wouldn't be able to do just like boom in a turn or two, depending upon the size of the empire.
Nope.
There is a cheat, a human player cheat, give it away, and Clockwork Orange on the 2K forums says that this annoying cheat happened the past few games I've played multiplayer. And basically, whenever a human player is about to lose a city to another human player, and occasionally to the AI, he she gives the city away, often to the weakest player in the game. It's real annoying because it ruins momentum and often blocks a path to their other cities. Then, if you still want to take it, you have to declare war on the other civ, which runs up the warmonger penalty. Is this a cheat? Is there a way to fix this? And my personal opinion is summed up by the next comment by Pixel Ripper. It's not so much a cheat, it's a tactic. Then it comes down to really, do you find your game, not Civ in general, but the game that you're playing at that moment, are you playing it as a I'm here to win tactical and I'm using all the rules to my advantage? Or are you thinking, well, this is realism, I want to roleplay a relationship with other AI countries? And that's what it comes down to. I mean, I've done it before. I'm guilty of this, playing against the AI and saying, oh, look, this is just annoying. If I give that there, they have a problem. It's a tactic. But in real life, it would never happen. It's not a way to simulate real warfare. But then again, this is not Crusader Kings 2.
Or EU4. Yeah. Those are simulations.
They have their own problems. Yeah. But one thing they do that Civ probably should do here, I can't believe I'm saying this because usually it's the other way around. They don't let you sell crap while you're fighting in a war.
Yeah.
If you have enemy units in your city borders, you probably shouldn't be able to sell that city. Maybe you shouldn't be able to sell cities at war at all. But at least if you have enemy units in your borders, you should not be able to sell that city.
Or even just give it away. Not even sell it. Just say, here, take, please.
It's not cheating by definition. It's definitely not cheating, but it's a questionable game mechanic to be
fair. And people say it's more poor sportsmanship and spoil sport more than anything else. It's basically in a multiplayer setting if you're trying to be competitive. It's the screw you, I'm not going to let you get what you actually earned from me.
Yeah.
So, meh.
Yeah, but aren't there so many other things as well in a Civ game that we could call poor sportsmanship, but the rules allow, and yet it happens?
I think that what it now comes down to, even if it's not quote-unquote fixed in the game, like Phil is addressing, then people who are going to be doing this in MP, word of mouth is a very powerful thing, even in the days of our technology, and people are going to soon know who these individuals are. Certain you could be like, oh, well, I'm in Steam, I'll just go ahead and change my name, blah, 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 blah. Well, besides the fact that there's a history record of names, or you could go to some extreme measures to create multiple accounts, blah, 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 blah. But pretty soon, you're going to be a pretty lonely person trying to play MP, if this is something you're doing, because most people aren't going to put up with it, because like has been said, it's a tactic, and it's cheap, and it's poor sportsmanship, and people who are really competitive, and even people who are not so competitive, aren't going to put up with poor sportsmanship. We even see this in co-op-ish moments that are turncast, where we're competing against the AI, and someone, I'm not going to be mentioning any names, even recently realized, I captured this city from this particular civilization, I don't want it, none of the human players want it, so they go ahead and give it to an AI that somebody else is fighting. All part and parcel with whether they're giving the city away to another human player. If you have AI in the game as well, then you could go ahead and do that. And quite frankly, you could do that in a single-player game. Oh, geez, Civilization X is going to take this city. I'll just give it to Civilization Y. We just don't talk about it as much because most people don't know those things happen.
There's other issues, too. Now, granted, he also talks about warmonger penalties, and those really don't matter unless you're using AI. If it's all humans in the game, yeah, there's no warmonger penalty, really.
Yeah, there's indeed two issues being brought up by Clockwork Orange at the same time, multiplayer and warmonger penalty, and those don't match. Warmonger penalty is not important in multiplayer. Yeah, you might have one or two AIs straggling on the side or something, but in a multiplayer game, really, who cares about warmonger penalty?
It's probably all warmongering anyway, so it's all out in the wash.
Yeah.
That's what most MP is, warmongering.
And AIs will get wiped out soon enough anyway, so who cares?
If you even have them.
Yeah. Depends on how you set things up, but if it's a competitive multiplayer game where humans are fighting humans and you're doing PvP, yeah, the AI doesn't matter.
Probably shouldn't put in AI because it's a substantial advantage to whoever happens to spawn your AI and not a human because they don't have to be honest.
Yeah. Otherwise, I would just say, tell people if you're hosting the game, tell them you may not sell cities to other people while at war, as a house rule sort of thing, and anybody breaks it, well, kick them out of the game.
Yep, that's a good idea, setting up a set of house rules. But you could also say, in this game, here are my house rules. By the way, give it away is allowed in this game, and see how people start changing their player tactics. You could say, in this game, one of the house rules is, it's a legit tactic. You might see some players say, hey, I want to go in for that because I really want to play a Civ game, trying to take advantage as much as I can about the rules built into the game by the programmers.
That's fine, too. As long as you have rules agreed upon ahead of time, then you can do anything, really.
And the longest rules are enforced as well.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. If you're the host of a game and you say there's none of this, and someone does it, in addition to calling them out, kick them out.
Yeah.
Make it a core rule that this is just not going to be permitted, and send them the message that way. If they have to learn the hard way, then so be it. And you might think, well, what if the host does it?
Well, then everybody else can leave.
Exactly. Send the message that way. That's no problem.
Instead of kicking him out, punishment being in-game, as in everyone gangs up on that one guy.
Nah.
Yeah.
Kicking him out basically means that they turn into an AI. Because if you actually leave it to, okay, everybody gang up on this guy, you might have people who agree to fight, but then don't actually do anything.
That, and I like the fact that if it's an in-house rule, then you're outside of the gameplay mechanics for the rule. So use an outside of gameplay mechanics for enforcing, which is Das Boot.
Hmm. Yeah.
Dan's favorite boat.
Now, someone might say, but Polycast, what if someone says that the in-house rule is allowed and you don't like it? Well, I guess it depends. How much don't you like it? You can leave. You can try to convince a change before you leave, I suppose. But if in the end, on balance, you don't like it, then yeah, just leave. I'm certain there'll be someone else willing to take your place, or they'll just go ahead with one last player. That's fine.
I think usually if someone would see this as legitimate in an in-house rule before jumping into the game, they're going to realize this tactic is going to be used left, right, and center. That's why it has been legitimized for this game.
Yeah. Unless they're ever going to come along and switch it to what Phil suggested as in, if at war, can't sell cities. Because that also assumes that they might even consider another patch. But
I wonder if this problem is going to pop up in CBE.
I was going to play Brazil, the first game, but now I think I'm going to play Polystralia. is led by Hutama. It's very interesting. It goes into where they looked at the history and stuff of Australia to kind of give them an idea of where they and the other countries right around them that are part of the South Pacific would go in that period before with the Great Mistake to pull them together. They basically became the breadbasket of the world, which is an interesting idea. But it gave them a lot of economic power, so they're going to be the economic faction of the game, and they are led by Hutama there, who leads them, is this is kind of reminding me of the Morganites from Alpha Centauri a little bit, because the guy is also a billionaire and kind of a personality.
Not just a little bit. It's Morgan. It's Morgan in a different costume.
Pretty much. Yeah. Different way of accumulating wealth, but same idea.
Which I found ironic, because I thought that the American corporation faction would be the Morgans. Apparently not.
But yeah, the American Reclamation Corporation comes up in this discussion as a inherently hostile faction.
Yeah, well, the Australians are more friendly. They're more likely to work with you and cooperate as opposed to go straight to nukes to the face.
Corner to your market.
Well, as long as you have money. Yeah.
So, like, the American Corporation is like the bad capitalist, and Hutama is like the good capitalist, and that's weird.
I have a question now. They say Australia became the food source of the whole world. Do they understand that 90% of Australia is not arable?
Well, they said about kind of agricultural techniques. So
do they understand that the center of Australia is full of salt water, and that's where all water drains into? So they would have to desalinate half their continent.
Maybe they just central desert to the world's biggest fish tank.
Hey, Matt, maybe they found a way to just clone food, you know? Like, what? This is sci-fi.
This is sci-fi.
A problem. I recently read a book about this and agriculture in Australia, and indeed, the whole place is a salt pan. There's two places which can grow some kind of food. One of them needs a constant influx of fertilizer to do anything. Australia is nutrient dead as a continent. There's no nutrients in the soil. So for it to become the breadbasket of the world, either we're talking about aquaculture and they learned how to use all their coastline to grow food, or they've done some kind of weird thing where they can clone food out of pure energy and salt or something like that. Unless Australia is taking into account all the other islands around there and you include Indonesia, and that starts to make sense because they do have a nutrient-rich land. But
except Indonesia also has a population-rich land.
Yeah, but 200 years' time, you don't know. They might all be gone.
Yeah. And we don't know what the coastline or anything looks like, because we've seen, like, flooding near the pyramids, so we have no idea how much that is. But, you know, my brain immediately jumped to aquaculture when they said that would probably be most likely, because that's a lot of ocean.
And if you raise the sea level and you start to see what happens to the map of Australia, there is a big central lake in the middle of Australia. Now, okay, it'll be too salty to do anything with, but maybe in the future the sea levels raise so much and the river paths change so much that suddenly that lake became the aquaculture breadbasket of the world or something. But still, it's kind of weird. It really would need Star Trek level of technology.
Well, that, and you combine the fact that Will Miller, who's the co-lead designer on Beyond Earth, when he talks about that this happens after the Great Mistake, Polystrelia becomes the food source of the whole world. What is the whole world? Like, what the Great Mistake is could have eliminated half of the planet now in terms of population. So the whole food source, it also becomes a question of what is the population of the planet? So certainly for today, for this area to become the food source for the entire world, Starfolk talks about genetic engineering and other things that Fabio was saying, that would be in an extreme, but in terms of relativity in the context, if we knew or at least inferred that the population is considerably decimated then as compared to now, maybe they could, combined with genetic engineering and the like, become the food source for the entire planet. But I think more generally, I can't help but laugh when I read about this faction in particular, but also the next one, because often it comes up, and I know Mackie said, oh, we don't have to worry about questions of historical context and who ends up being the leaders. There isn't going to be debates about that. But I still think you get into politicast discussions because already it's like, even things like the name, like Polystrelia, what? Or why would you think this area would actually unite because of this difference and that difference? And it's like, oh, here we go.
You don't know what happened to them during the Great Mistake, and maybe they all put aside everything and says, you know, this was stupid.
Well, what was the Great Mistake?
We like, don't know.
Let's just say that the Great Mistake involved nuclear fallout on most of the world. Well, maybe Australia is the most nutrient-rich place now because you can't grow anything anywhere else. I mean,
exactly.
You can go any direction you feel like with that. And that would definitely change the world's political landscape if you had something on that kind of scale. So, I don't know. I don't think it's too big a deal here.
What I do really love is that with all these factions and the news we get, that in the CFC forums, there's so much richness in arguments
documentation about how realistic it is for certain regions of the world to come together, like Polynesia and Australia. I mean, 200 years ago, no one would have said, Europe is going to come together. They would have said, there's far too much cultural diversity. Polynesia and Australia, well, there's less cultural diversity there, and there's more and more Asian influence in Australia day by day. It's just fun to read the forums about how people get so worked up about this region will never become like non-Anglo-Saxon or this region and the Slavic forum.
Never say never.
Exactly.
I love the Slavic forum. I just, oh man.
Pages. Well, yeah. And I mean, people really debating realism about stuff in the future and science fiction.
Yes. What do you do?
Really, people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's some basis. Like, if you come up with some sci-fi that doesn't even have any basis in reality, then that's bad sci-fi.
Well, I agree.
Good sci-fi always starts with something that is real or is potentially real, and then it builds on that and obviously gets away into the fi side of it. But there is that fi.
Well, yeah.
It has to start in the sci before it becomes fi.
Yeah, that's why there's the thing about after the great mistake, well, half the population is now gone. Okay, that could be the basis for Polystralia, as it's named, becoming the food basket of the planet. Although the Star of Hope has an interesting interpretation. The great mistake was running out of coffee. Sally Mackey went and killed half of the world's population.
So the great mistake was keeping coffee from Mackey. Okay.
Coffee.
But actually, beyond that article, even though it was titled to say, hey, we're going to find out about Polystralia and only Polystralia, it actually goes...
Favors?
Yeah, the favors. So this is a new idea for Civ Diplomacy, and this is a David McDonough, the other co-lead designer, speaking here. Getting the AI to agree to pay you back for something that you give them. For the example, if the AI is low on money and they ask you to divert some energy their way, they'll offer you one or more favors in return. These you can store up and use later on to require, shall we say, that the AI agree to requests that you make. That request can be up to and including declaring war on your behalf. So favors give you a long-term mastermind puppeteer perspective on the diplomatic play of the game. And of course, the up to and including declaration of war probably also has to do with how else, first off, you've interacted with that sponsor or not up to that point. And then, of course, also tied to it has been discussed the affinity that you choose, be it harmony, supremacy, or purity. I also liked when Miller said, just back to the factions, he would not talk about their weaknesses. And in fact, Miller says it's important to us that there aren't any systemic weaknesses when you're selecting a civ. I like that he also talks about the Civ when we often hear that it's sponsors, but okay, one and the same. We want it to be a choice between a big list of very good things, so what you don't take with you is the penalty for what you do. I say, I think, generally speaking, the average Civ player, PC-based Civ player, will be like, so long as it's not to the extreme of goodness that were the Civilization Revolution civilizations, then okie dokie.
Well, it's basically just balance out the bonuses so that you don't need a negative to go with it. And that's fine, because I think as soon as you start slapping on negatives to civs, then you start limiting their ability to do stuff.
I think what's really embedded here, though, that I'm surprised hasn't gotten more rage, and maybe it's just because all of the dense conversation about Polystralia embedded before and afterwards and other previews and interviews, I don't remember seeing this before, but Gunna, there's a lot more under-the-table interaction you can have between civilizations. Uh-huh. We have technology you can use to spy on other factions. Mm-hmm. You can smuggle wealth and goods from their lands. Oh. You can sabotage and even plan coup attempts in their cities to take control of them. Hello.
Actually, I think the one thing that got buried in there that you didn't mention was McDonough saying, yeah, so functionally diplomacy is fairly close to what it was in Civ 5. I think that line will cause more trouble on the forums than anything else. There was a lot of people hoping that they'd overhaul diplomacy or try and make it like Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, that line didn't just cause trouble on the forums, it caused troubles in my heart because I was really hoping for something else. But I'm happy that they've put in a couple of little different things so that it's just not the same game, because I don't want to play the same game.
I guess I saw that line and I thought, yeah, well, this is based on the Civ 5 engine, yeah, so.
Well, it just means they could have made it better, because diplomacy was, like, the worst thing in Civ 5 for most people.
I was about to say, it wasn't the worst thing for me, but okay, yeah. There was also about victory, and I think this is just kind of a confirmation from what we've seen about types of victory conditions that have been discussed before. Miller, we took a long look at the victory in Civilization and decided that a lot of victories that Civilization has previously had, where you accumulate a value and all of a sudden you win, those were not as exciting to us. Those aren't in the game. The victories are more involved projects that you have to do, they have a greater expression on the map, and are much more transparent to the other players. For example, one, which I guess you could call the technology victory, but it's really the victory anyone can do regardless of their affinity, is the contact victory. Its whole process can take 50 or more turns, and all the while you have to be very careful about your diplomatic interactions and any wars you have going on to protect these pieces of infrastructure you have in order to complete it. And I immediately thought of spaceship victory in Civilization V.
Wait.
Oh, you think you're going to be launching that, do you? Completing all these parts, do you? Mm-hmm.
Don't think so. Boom.
Wait, the process can take 50 turns? How fast do they want the game over?
Well, they said 50 or more turns.
Yeah.
So people who want to speed through it.
No, that's the question of, okay, when can you start it? I mean, if you can't start it until, like,
how far do you have to
build
up the tech web to get there?
What speed are you playing on as well? Probably also takes into account that, too.
It also takes into account if you're thinking, well, it takes 50 or more turns to actually do a victory condition, is your strategy not going to be that you're doing multiple victory conditions at the same time? Because these things take so long, I'm not thinking like, well, halfway through my save game, I'm already starting to build the wonder which is going to win the game. Maybe I'm building two different wonders who can win the game because the one I'm building in that city is very close to the bad guys.
Who knows?
And who would the bad guys be? Is that Polystralia? You want to fight about it? I couldn't resist.
If you just conquer everybody, you can pick your victory condition later.
The Star of Hope says in the chat, and this gets back to about the line about comparing Beyond Earth Diplomacy to Civ 5. It makes sense to me to take what you had in Civ 5 and mostly modifying it, knowing what was weak about it, then to create something new and discover it has a whole new set of problems to fix. Ah,
yeah.
So yeah, in other words, the devil you know?
Well, no. Improving the one you know is what Star Hope says, but functionally diplomacy is fairly close to what it was in Civ 5, means they did take the Civ 5 diplo, but didn't necessarily go very far with it.
Well, you would have to know the devil before you could improve on the devil, because how would you know it was an improvement if you didn't know them in the first place? Ha!
I think by this time everyone knows the devil in Civ 5. We've played it often enough.
Yes, the player. They're the devil.
We got another faction revealed as well. This one does not have a Q&A attached to it, but there will also be a Franco-Iberia faction. And as a EU4 player, that just sounds disgusting. But I need to get away from that because this is a different game.
Sounds
definitely a different game. So we're all good. We're all good.
How dare you bring your bias into this game, Phil? How dare you, sir?
This is natural in EU4, Franco-Iberia Hugbox.
Yeah.
Okay.
Personal union. Thumbs up. They're even bringing in North Africa into this.
Right, yeah, that the territories belonging include the former France and Spain, parts of Italy, and extends along the Mediterranean to include parts of North Africa.
Culturally speaking, when you look at Italy, you can quite easily split it into three different parts, at least two, north and south. There is, in the article, or maybe another article, it has been mentioned that the Franco-Iberia, I can't get used to that name, is the new Rome. So I'm assuming they have Rome as a city. And
it did mention they had parts of Italy, so.
Yeah,
what?
So
this faction is culture focused. That doesn't sound like Rome.
Rome is just a bunch of Rome. Well, that's why it's not just Rome, Phil. I do maintain, though, as this person continues talking about the faction, they start reaching too much. While they receive a number of bonuses, including a free virtue technology, which gives them a wide range of flexibility in the sense that you won't have to sacrifice scientific progress if you prioritize culture and the development of your cities. It's a free virtue technology, people. Whoa, easy.
What's a virtue technology?
There's the other question. But he says, in addition to its depth and its bonuses to virtues, Franco-Iberia is able to respond to changing situations in the game more comfortably than many of the other factions. How the heck do you know that?
Maybe he played the game.
Oh, and he's played it sufficiently at this point to come with that assertion in a game that's also not even finished yet. Come on now.
This is just extrapolation and a form of trying to talk about the actual faction without referring purely to game turn stuff so that it has more depth.
People are trying to extrapolate how it is that they may or may not be in gameplay. But the designers have made it quite clear that they're not taking that approach. There's no, oh, if you play this faction, then they're going to be automatically inclined because that's who they are. They're supposed to be taking into account more gameplay-specific things like map, where they're located, who's around them, etc., etc.
Well, having read this article and more about Elodie and Franco-Iberia, as a European, I can really just say that I am hoping that there is a DLC or expansion with some kind of other side of Europe which is represented than this snobbery.
Oh, possibly. Who knows? The old Europe, and this is the old families of Europe. Yeah, this makes sense. This actually does exist today, sort of.
Ah, but will it exist in 200 years?
Well, maybe they paid for bunkers from the Great Mystique, or they built a wall around Paris. Whatever.
Like I said at the beginning of the episode, what's old is new again.
Yep.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-218-7659. That's 441-218-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
And I would put to you that there is another role-playing option of not using nukes. Maybe you're just really a nice guy and say, you know what? I'm not the type of person who nukes people. I just flatten their cities with GDRs.
I'm just going to pepper you with bombers.
Okay. So fine, I fortify mech infantry around my city so that you can't land and attack. Now what? Your XCOM squad is now attacking something that has more combat strength than it.
Well, cruise missiles can weaken the infantry until they're beatable.
Ah, so we're back to combined arms, are we?
Apparently so.
Is cruise missile really a combined arm? Isn't it just not a cheap bomber?
Well, what happens if XCOM really drop next to a city and they just get carpeted by bombers?
Yeah, sounds like anything else.
Well, combined arms means that you have more than three different types of units. So, like, say, in the olden days, you had archers, plus dudes with sharp swords at the front, plus cavalry. Now, there's a combination of three. When you just have an artillery, like catapults and warriors, that's not really combined arms. That's two dudes. But if you have, there's
they're
a reason to have archers.
But you're making up a definition here. That's two different arms. You're combining them.
What's the point of having two long-distance units, like archers and catapults? Well, the reason is because they're used for different things. And then where you get to the point where there's no two different types of long-distance units. There's just rocket artillery. That's less combination. It makes it more boring.
Rocket artillery and helicopters. Helicopters are faster than XCOM. And they give you the thing.
I've never really found a use for helicopters. They're quite easy to kill.
Depends on if you upgrade them. 8-move blitzed helicopters. Get in, they hit, they leave.
Scoot and shoot.
It's always fun to one-shot the AI in one turn, isn't it? I'm pretty sure you've been able to do it in every Civ game, too.
A very easy way to one-shot an AI is if you put all your spies, like, let's say you've got six spies and they have six cities, and you just make sure there's a spy in every city, then you have total view of their entire empire, and then you start dropping the bombs and dropping the XCOMs, because you can see everything.
It was probably harder to one-shot a big nation in Civ 4, but you could do it. I think you do it in any Civ game.
Anyways, is there a segue to this one? Not really sure.
I think it's time we got out of here. Crap, I selected... Oh, yeah, it's 207. There's been so many. How am I supposed to remember them all? Anyway, this has been episode 207 of Polycast. I am joined by the usual suspects, such as Dan Quick.
Ready to launch.
Imagine.
Ride that segue.
On the mean team.
Everyone join my faction. My emphasis is on the non-existence of other factions.
And our guest this week, Fabius.
I still hate my job.
Just in case anyone forgot.
Bye.
Oh, and for Canis, I'm using a massive hack for my mic, so I'm not sure how close it has to be to my face to actually hear it. Canis was saying I was actually quiet comparatively.
I mean, whenever you see someone in the chat say that, just French the mic, you're probably... Canis says you sound better now. I hope that wasn't right afterwards.
Oh.
Wind tunnel.
Wind tunnel.
Coming soon on the Polycast album.
All right. He's saying XCOM units.
You're a little too close to the mic, Al.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you're pretty loud.
You've been segued. No, this isn't a segue for Dance Mom. Matthew.
Hey, I am not his mom. What the hell, guys?
Hey, yo.
I said this is not a segue for Dance Mom.
Segway? Matthew hears what Matthew wants to hear.
Yeah, apparently. It's not new. They've had them since they...
I was going to play Brazil the first game, but now I think I'm going to play Polystralia. Two new factions.
Really?
That one's probably not actually new either.
Technically. New to me. Can we go with that?
That was a premature segue, and
moving on.
Hey-o.
Is that a segue? Is anyone riding a segue? Does anyone actually own one of those things?
Does it go woo, woo, woo?
How do people keep asking that? You contributed to the conversation and helped steer the conversation as well, so that's always good. Always appreciated.
Yay, I'm appreciated. I'm like, it works.
Of course, it makes it difficult for me to cut you out of the episode now, but not still.
That's what really happens.
Record date August 2nd, 2014. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth SoundClips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.